So my computer crashed, actually, while I was trying to help people with homework last night, which was embarrassing. No, it was fine, except it was sort of like, you know, I'm supposed to be somewhat good at computers, at least you think. And so the idea that, no, wait, I'll help you. My computer just freezes up. Anyway, it took all my clicker questions. It took today's clicker questions with it. I have no idea what my clicker questions were going to be. So I need you guys to ask me some questions now so I can make up some clicker questions. You want this to happen, right? Because, like, you know, it's like 10 points per. So we should probably do like 2 or 3 of them. What did we talk about last time? We talked about sorting, right? Quick sort, insertion sort.
That's where we left off.
Yeah. I'm drawing a blank. So anyway, any questions about the homework?
Number one is extra credit.
Yes.
So if we tried and got it wrong, what would
be
like? No.
Yeah, if you try it and you get it right, you get extra points. If you don't try it, 0. But if you try and get it wrong, you lose 200 points. No. I mean, yeah, is that what you're asking? If you try it and get it wrong, then, you know, no skin off anybody's nose. One thing that, for some reason or other, it didn't come across in the way that I phrased the question. There's 3 routines and 3 descriptions. You're supposed to just match them up.
Yeah.
Okay. Some people were very surprised to find out that's what I was trying to convey.
There's a typo in your thing also. So, like, you have to make a Sakai program.
Yes. Yeah. This was pointed out to me. Okay. Sherry told me that. Scratch, Sakai, they all blend together in my head. Sorry. Not a typo so much as a thinko, right? It's not like, ooh, I slipped and I typed the entirely wrong word. It starts with an S. So was there questions from the homework? Did anybody want to see? So one of the things I did last night, I don't think I sent this around to everybody, but people who are on the chat room could see it, is I made a scratch program of There Was an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Fly. You know that one? So, like, you know, there was an old lady who swallowed a fly, I don't know why she swallowed it, because it was a fighter, and because it was a tickle tiger, and it was a fly, I don't know why she swallowed it, perhaps she'll die. But then also swallowed birds, and the birds catch spiders, the spider catch fly, I don't know why she swallowed it, perhaps she'll die. But the old lady said, anyway, you know this. You do know this one, right? So people apparently didn't know the Jack one as well as I thought maybe you would. So anyway, so there were 2 ways that I was thinking you would do the Jack one. One looks like this, which basically says that there's a main subroutine that calls, first it does verse 1, then it does verse 2, then it does verse 3, then it does verse 4, and each verse has inside of it the other verses. So verse 3 says, she swallowed the bird to catch the spider. Then it goes to verse 2. Verse 2 says, she swallowed the spider to catch the fly, and calls verse 1. Verse 1 says, I don't know why she swallowed the fly. It may actually have been terminal. And that ends that series of subroutine calls. So you can do the same trick with the Jack story, because it really has a very similar structure. That was not what I thought you would do originally, because I didn't realize that you could get away with this. So what I was expecting actually was something that looked a little more like this. And again, this wouldn't work as the answer to the homework because it's a different story, but similar structure. So here the idea is that we're going to have a loop, a repeat until loop, and it's going to loop through all the verses. So N says what verse we're currently on, and it starts off at 1. So first we're going to do the first verse, and we're going to repeat until we get past verse 5. And here's what we do. Here's what we repeat. If it's verse 1, then we say, there was an old lady who swallowed a fly. That's how we start the verse. Otherwise, if it's not verse 1, say it's verse 2, then we start the verse this way. There was an old lady who swallowed a spider that wriggled and wiggled and apparently tiggled inside her. I don't know why I did that. But anyway, so there's a different beginning to each of those verses, except for verse 5, which says, there was an old lady who swallowed a horse. She's dead, of course. Stop script. I kind of like that finality of the song and the script. All right, so then after it sings the opening, then it counts down like this. If the verse number is bigger than 3, say she swallowed the cat to catch the bird. If the verse number is bigger than 2, you then say she swallowed the bird to catch the spider. If the verse is bigger than 1, it says she swallowed the spider to catch the fly. And then no matter what, you end with, I don't know why she swallowed the fly, perhaps she'll die. Then change N by 1. In other words, go on to the next verse. And it goes back up to the top of the loop and does it all again with the next verse. So people were asking, well, what about variables? How do you do variables? Why are you telling me to do variables? I really don't want to do that. I have no idea what you're talking about. That's what I was talking about. And this structure, if you were to do this with the Jack song, would be very similar. And in fact, the Jack one is a little bit easier because this beginning part is simpler. I think all you have to do is say, there was, something like that. What do you say in Jack's song?
This is,
thank you. Yeah, so this is the moth that sat on the cat that ate the fish that talked to my friends that lived in whatever it is. Anyway. Okay? Any other questions on any other questions? Yeah?
With the spinner question,
where you asked
the four colors,
yes.
Where you asked the probability of getting a primary color?
Yes.
How would you do that? Like,
So let me say one thing first. Averages are not necessarily integers, right? If you were computing the average age of everybody in your family, it probably won't turn into a whole number, right? It's probably something with a 0.5 or a 0.25, something like that, right? So if you don't feel like it has to be an integer, because I said it was an average, does that make it any easier?
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent.
What if we left it in, like, fraction form or whatever?
Oh, like say, I don't know, like 11 thirds as opposed to 3 and 2 thirds? Those are the same number as far as I can tell. It's also the same as 3.66666. Yeah.
And
I don't want to do the literal one that I asked you to do, but I can do something like it. So here's what I would suggest. Can you think of something really simple that we could do with a list? So what I'd be happy to do is step you through an example that's different from one of these, but similar. So here's a list of numbers. What's a question you could ask about this list of numbers? And then I'll show you how to do it as a little scratch program like this. So here's a list of numbers. Or maybe I should say it this way. Here's a list of numbers. I don't know. What about it? So the question here was, given a list of numbers, I wrote three different subroutines. One of them just answers the question, does this list contain the number one? One of them answers the question, is the list sorted in increasing order? And the other one answers the question, does the first element in the list appear somewhere else in the list? So those are three examples of questions that correspond to three little scratch programs or pseudo scratch programs. The thing that's not valid scratch is this is a big L. Scratch can't do that. But you know, I can show you some scratch for a different example if you could help me think of a different example. You got nothing. How about does it contain an even number? Okay. All right, so if I wanted to answer the question, does the list contain an even number? So let me put the pseudo scratch back up. So it goes something like, when I receive even Q, I don't know, repeat until n less than 1. So what do I need to do? So for each element in the list, I'm going to ask myself a question. Is this element even? So this is, I'm trying to ask the question, is there an even number in the list? So that's the question. We're trying to match that up with the scratch program. So repeat telling. So if L of n is even. Can I just say that, or do you want to see that in math? Is even. Then set answer 1, stop script. And then change n by minus 1. That's the end of the repeat loop. And then we run, oh. Then we say set answer to 0. I guess that's the end. We could have a stop script after that if we wanted.
Oh, so like if looking at each individual number in the list, then if that number is even, it'll set the answer to 1. Stop the script. And then change that 1
box. No, no, then it stops the script. If it's even, it stops the script, then the story's over.
And then does it refer to that change by negative?
No. If it finds an even number, it says, oh, I know the answer to this question. Yes, there's an even number in the list. And it stops. If it doesn't find an even number, if ln is not even, if the current one that's swinging n is not even, then it goes down to here and changes n by minus.
Then if the value is not, after changing by the own, the value is not less than 1, then it keeps going.
Yeah, so what it's doing is it's going from the list back to front. 5, is that even? No, keep going. 1, is that even? No, keep going. 6, is that even? Yes. Set answer to 1, that means yes, stop the script. Game's over. Right, you don't have to scan the whole list. Once you find an even number, you're done.
Oh.
On the other hand, if it makes it all the way to the end of the list, the last element of the list, and hasn't found an even number, the loop terminates, at which point we know there wasn't an even number in the list. So we set our answer to no, there's not an even number in the list, and we stop the script.
Oh, so like for A, we're plugging in 1 in each of these lists and testing it until we find one that works for the one where it will actually terminate.
Well, there's two ways to terminate, right? Either the if thing is successful, and then it gives 1 answer, or it goes all the way through the loop and it never, the if thing was never true, and then it gives a different answer and stops. They all have this exact same structure. They all are looping through, they're testing each element, and if they find that a certain property holds that element, then it returns a certain answer. If it doesn't, then it just keeps looking through the list until it gets to the end of the list, or the beginning of the list, and then says, okay, I've gone all the way through the list, and it never, this condition never held, therefore I give a different answer.
No, I'm saying, like, for the specific question, like, does this list contain the number 1? If it terminates for the number 1, then that would be it. Like, but if it doesn't, then it's not the correct list or routine.
If the routine is the right routine, if it has the property that if you gave it a list that has a 1 in it, it will return the answer yes or 1. And if you gave it a list that doesn't have 1 in it, then it'll return 0, meaning no.
Okay.
It'll actually go through and like do a test on every element of the list. And there's three different algorithms, there are three different little routines that are actually testing three different questions. Okay? That? Help? Okay. But that's still not a quicker question. Should I make a quicker question out of that? What are we going to talk about today? We're going to talk about compression. We've been talking for the last couple weeks about Chapter 5. So Chapter 5 was about algorithms, about coming up with recipes or strategies for solving different kinds of problems using a computer and trying to quantify which kinds of algorithms are better than others. And the ones were better were the ones that had slower growth rates, the ones that as the size of the data that they were working on gets bigger, they don't get much slower. You don't like algorithms that as the data gets bigger, they get much, much slower. That would be bad, because then they can't solve very big problems. So that's mostly what we talked about. The chapter had a little bit at the end, actually it may have even been split more evenly than that, on what Hillis called heuristics, which people in AI mostly call algorithms also. But these are algorithms, these are strategies for doing things that don't necessarily work. They just work some of the time. Maybe a lot of the time, but not necessarily all the time. And so he gave some examples of that, and I can give you some examples, but I don't think I can spend enough time on it to really get you to get it. So I was thinking,
you can get what you can out of the Hillis book. And if you have questions about it, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I was going to say chapter 5 is done. Let's move on to chapter 6.
So, just somebody remind me at some point that I should ask a clicker question, because it would be a bummer if we got to the end of that. All right, so chapter 6 is called Memory, Information, and Secret Codes. Mostly the chapter is about using bits to represent things in the world, things that we care about. Names, numbers. We talked about numbers already. Lists of things, pictures, sounds. Right? Sequences of bits can represent lots and lots of different things. And it turns out you have choices. Just like when you're talking about algorithms, there's different choices. You could run a quick sort or a selection sort. There's different ways that you can represent things, or so different ways that you can solve things. In this chapter, is mostly about there are different ways to represent things using bits. And some of them are better for some things and better for others. So what I'd like to get across is this notion, how can we represent letters with bits? And are there better and worse ways of doing that? What are some of the advantages of it? So when we try to figure out a way of representing something with bits, there are competing interests. There's things, reasons that we'd want it to be one way and reasons we want it to be another. So we'd like it to be easily manipulated and processed, right? So if we're trying to represent a number with bits, we'd like it to be in a form that makes it easy to do things like addition, multiplication, testing if it's even, dividing by something, taking a square root. We want the things that we're going to do with that item or that object to be as simple as possible. On the other hand, we'd also like the number of bits to represent something to be small. We'd like the representation to be short. Why does it matter if the number of bits to represent something is short?
Yeah. Save memory.
Yeah, well, it saves, for one thing, it saves memory, right? So if we're going to represent, say, the number 1,000 by 1,000 bits, right? Like a tally, almost. One bit for each number in the number. Certain things become very easy. Adding two numbers is just pooling the bits. You don't have to do it with carries. There's all sorts of things you don't have to worry about when you're doing counting by tallying. But on the other hand, if you're talking about very big numbers, if we wanted to represent the number 1,000,000, we would need more space than we have on all these chalkboards, probably. So you want to keep it small so that it fits in the memory of the computer, which is limited. Also, if we're going to transmit our answers to other people, like if we're a cable station or YouTube or something like that, people want our videos. We have to send them to them in bits. That's the only thing we can send with computers. The only thing we can store, it's the only thing we can send. So if we're going to send them to other people, we want to send as little as possible. So there's lots of reasons for wanting it to be short. On the other hand, what is that old? There's some old joke about these guys that are in a monastery or a prison or something, and they're there for a very long time. And they, when they all originally got together, they all had some jokes that they knew. And over time, they ended up sharing all their jokes with each other. And eventually, it got to the point that they were retelling the same jokes over and over again, so they really sort of didn't bother anymore giving the whole joke. They would just give the punchline. And people would all laugh. Then later, they got to the point where they're like, you know what, even the punchline is too much. Let's just say the joke number. We'll give each joke a number, and I'll just say 17, and everyone will laugh. Right? That sort of thing. So it's very efficient, right? You get 17, very short. It's much, much shorter than going, you know, there was a rabbi and a snowman and a caterpillar and they were all in a bar. Right? You have all these words. If you wanted to just convey the joke really short, you could just say 17. On the other hand, it sort of loses some information, right? There's disadvantages to making it that short because people who don't know the joke can't turn the 17 into anything, so it's not actually funny to you. So that's what bits is all about, you know, trying to make sure that things are funny. But anyway, the point is that, all right. Different ways of representing it, but we're trying to strike a balance between having it have the information in an easy to work with form and keeping it short. So, as I said, the chapter is about this in various ways he talks about this. I'm only going to talk about one idea that he doesn't even really talk about, but he hints at it. And I think it's interesting and it's concrete enough that we can actually play with it. So if you want to learn more about it, it's called Huffman coding. If you want to learn more about it, you can go to the Wikipedia page. They have a pretty decent description of what's going on. And the lecture notes, I also describe it. So let's see, is there one other thing to say? So Huffman was this dude. Huffman was a guy who was For the purpose of this story, he was a graduate student at MIT, and he was taking a class with some other guy who had worked on a problem for many years and couldn't solve it. So the teacher decided to give that problem as a homework problem to his class, and figuring that the best they would do is come up with what he came up with. He had a published paper with Claude Shannon where they talk about this problem, and they didn't solve it, but they said, but here's a pretty decent thing to do. Maybe you can do better, I don't know. Anyway, he signed it as a homework problem, assuming that people would actually come up with that, except for Huffman, who was taking the class, said, no, what if you just do that same thing but do it backwards? It turned out that gives you the optimal answer. And so the teacher was kind of, well, he was probably upset. But but the rest of us are really happy because Huffman ended up inventing this kind of coding, which is really very elegant and powerful. So let me try to motivate this idea. So this is the Gettysburg Address. Lincoln delivered this. I'm going to say in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And there's a lot of words in it, right? If we're going to try to store this in our computer, we have to come up with some way of representing the Gettysburg Address. Now, again, we could call it, 17, but somehow how are we going to turn that 17 back into the Gettysburg Address? So instead, what we're going to do, the way we're going to talk about it, is each letter in the whole sequence is going to be represented by some bits. Okay? So like the letter P is going to be some pattern of bits. And the way we're going to turn the whole Gettysburg Address into bits is we'll take the first letter, turn it into its bit pattern, take the second letter, turn it into its bit pattern, and just string them all together from beginning all the way to the end. Okay? We would like all the letters to have codes that are short, because then that'll make the whole thing short. But we can't make them all say one bit, right? What if we said P is going to be just one, that'll be the pattern for P, and I don't know, so O will be the pattern 0, because it looks kind of like 0. And I guess E, that'll also have to be 0, because it's also like a 0, and we're also kind of out of patterns at this point. L can be 1s, because, they look like 1s. The problem with this is it's easy to take this and make a very short code out of it, but you can't quite go from that code back to the Gettysburg Address, because if I tell you 0, you don't know, was that an E or an O? If I tell you 1, was that a P or an L? You don't know. So we want it to be unambiguous. We want it to be short, but unambiguous, so that we can get back to the original pattern, the original text. Okay? Everybody okay with that? Okay. So just to keep things simple, what we're going to do is pretend the whole Gettysburg Address is all in lowercase, and pretend that in terms of punctuation, it only has space. What's B? Oh, line break, comma, dash, period, question mark, all the letters of the alphabet, okay? And what I did here is I took each of the letters of the alphabet, each of those punctuations, and I just counted up how often it appeared in the Gettysburg Address. So here's what we're going to do first. I'm going to tell you a coding scheme called ASCII. ASCII stands for American Standard Code for Information Interchange. The point is that, at least until Bill Gates came by, we had all agreed on a series of bit patterns that correspond to letters. The Microsoft folks added a couple things to it, and it still breaks programs that I run even today. At least once a day, I get to curse Bill Gates. It's very nice. He keeps stays in the front of my mind. And so, quotes. The big problem, I don't know if you've ever seen this thing, but if you do a cut and paste of something with quotation marks in it from something that's Microsoft to something that's not Microsoft, it doesn't. The receiving thing doesn't know what the code is that Microsoft uses for quotes, and it puts in like some kind of sound. It's really horrible. But anyway, all right. So, but ASCII, people came up with this years ago, and they decided, all right, we're gonna set aside 8-bit patterns. 8 bits. Why 8? I don't know. It's power 2. Makes it easy. It's a byte. It's a number of tentacles on an octopus. The point is that 8-bit pattern. Each letter is going to get an 8-bit pattern. Each 8-bit pattern is going to get either a letter or some other kind of control code. The Gettysburg Address, if you count up all the characters in it, the number of letters and punctuation marks, it's 1,482. And so each of those characters, if you represent them in ASCII, is 8 bits. We're going to just string them one after the other until we're all done. That's a total of 11,856 bits to write down the Gettysburg Address using this particular representation. 8 bits per character, 11,856 total bits. That's the ASCII representation. Does anybody actually want to know any, like 65 is A, 66 is B? Mostly the letters, have nice adjacent codes to them, so that's kind of helpful in some ways. The digits all have nice adjacent codes. I forget what they are. It's easy enough to find out. But anyway, if you'd actually like to see the table of what the actually ASCII bit patterns correspond to in letters, I can get that for you. But it's standard, and it's been this way for many, many years. But here's the thing. How many different 8-bit patterns are there? Well, there's at least one. 0000. Oh, wait, there's another one. 0000001. Actually, maybe there's a bunch. All right, there's one. There's another one. That's not bits.
No, that and the combination.
Oh! Where did that come from?
38.
Each of the 8 bits can be on or off. So the first one can be on or off, can take on 2 different values. The second one can be on or off, it can take on 2 different values. The third one. So the number of different combinations is 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, 8 times, or 2 to the 8, which is indeed 256. Alright? So there's 256 different patterns that we could represent with 8 bits. It turns out that the Gettysburg Address, if we're just looking at the Gettysburg Address, it only actually has 32 different characters in it. So, for 32, how many bits do we need to represent 32 different patterns? Well, 8 bits is 2 to the 8, or 256 patterns. 32 is 2 to the, let's see, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, one, I've gone too far. 32 is 5. The number of 5-bit patterns is 32. So we really only need to differentiate between these different patterns, these 32 different patterns. So we could easily get by just making up, for each 5-bit pattern, 00000, 00001, 00010. That was ABC, say. Okay? If we assign each of the 5-bit patterns to one of the letters that we need for the Gettysburg Address, we have 5 bits per pattern, a total of 7,410 bits, or about 5/8 the size of the regular ASCII representation. So now we've already got 2 different ways of writing down the Gettysburg Address. One is this big and one is like this big, right? So we're compressing it. We're representing the same information, but with fewer bits. Easier to store, easier to transmit, this is good. And it seems like maybe we're even kind of at the end of the road, right? Because there's 32 different letters that we need to be able to represent, and you need 5 bits. 5 bits gets you exactly 32 different patterns. It seems like one-to-one, we're kind of done. And so here's a choice. Here's the 32 different 5-bit patterns, and each one's assigned to one of the letters that appeared in the Gettysburg Address. And so now if we wanted to take... Well, so let's do this exercise. Oh, wait, we'll make it a clicker question. Because, we need a clicker question. Okay. Okay, that's a message using this code. Using this code. Okay? So what I want you to do is figure out which one I just wrote. Don't click yet.
You might need a little bit more space here. Excellent. All right. Can you see? Is it all right? They do start to run together after a while, don't they? Is that three zeros, two zeros? All right, are we good? Not yet? Any more time? No? All right. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Stopping. All right. So, since in this code everything is 5 bits, we can just take this sequence. It's going to be some multiple of 5 long, right? Because each 5-bit group is going to be 1 letter. So I'm just going to break them up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay? Well, we're done because there's 4 letters. Only one of the choices was 4 letters. But let's not jump to conclusion. I did, over the weekend, somebody emailed me. No, I found this on my own by accident. It was a quiz of 8 questions. Complete nonsense. But they're all multiple choice. And by using, like, cleverness about how people make bad multiple choice tests, you could solve the problem. Like if I had said, you know, fill in the blank and I left 4 letter blanks and only one of the choices was 4, you don't have to know the answer, you can just figure out which one is right. I was thinking of maybe using those as bigger questions. But anyway, so we know, all right, let's go through this. So the first letter is whatever the code 01100 is, 01100. They're in numerical order, so I can quickly focus in and see if that's G. Then there's 10100. 10100 is the code for O. And here it is again. And then 01001. 01001 is D. So, all right, good enough. Okay. Now you should be able to go either way on these, right? If I give you a word like okay, you should be able to turn that into the bit code too by going to the table, finding O, 10100, going to the table and finding K. There it is, 10000, and then you've got okay. 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 All right, so going back to this slide. So, oh, here's Katie for this hand. How can we possibly do better than this? How can we represent the Gettysburg Address with fewer than 5 bits per character when there's 32 different characters and you need 5 bits to represent 32 different characters? I mean, we could leave one of the bits off, but then we're stuck, right? What if I say, oh, I don't know, X starts with, or ends with 1101. So let's just forget the first bit. We don't really need that. And I just say, okay, character 1101. What letter is that? Well, it could be X, but there's another one that ends with 1101, which is H. So that would be kind of a bummer. You don't want to mix up H and X. It's just not done. So what can we do? How can we possibly squeeze? We could write the bits smaller. Instead of writing big ones and zeros, we could just write them like this, and then it'll take up less space. Can't quite do that, right? I mean, they do make computers smaller, and that is why we can on a thumb drive now put, like, you know, a gig. But that's not really the point. That once you've got the gig thumb drive, you want to get as much information onto it as possible. So we want to compress the information without actually shrinking the individual bits. So how can we possibly use fewer bits to represent the Gettysburg Address?
Anybody got a thought on this? So let me hear. Here's a hint. The Gettysburg Address doesn't have any X's in it.
This is maybe something along the lines of how, like, maybe instead of using, like, you know how, like, there's, like, hexadecimal stuff like that?
I do.
Like, oh, yeah, like, how, you know, represents larger numbers with smaller, like, with fewer digits is something along those lines. Like,
right, so what hexadecimal does is it takes patterns of bits and replaces them by a single letter. So, like, you know, 1010 becomes A. So we could get by with fewer of them, but now there's more different letters per character. Yeah, well, it's a... Again, okay. All right, so, but that doesn't really help because A's not a bit. It doesn't actually give us any advantage. I'll call you after class. All right. So no, it has to be patterns of zeros and ones. We can't get by with anything else. So we can't turn zeros and ones into A through Z or something. Because yeah, this is kind of backwards. We're trying to figure out how to encode A through Z by zeros and ones. So the thing I wanted to point out, it has no J's. The Gettysburg Address has no J's, no Z's, and no X's. So we're kind of wasting codes on them. All right. If we know we're just going to encode the Gettysburg Address, we don't need a special code for X. We don't need a special code for J, right? Or question mark. He didn't ask any questions in the Gettysburg Address. He was telling us stuff. So, but that doesn't quite save us enough, right? There's 32 characters, but we don't need question mark. We don't need J. We don't need X or Z. So that's 28. There's only 28 characters that we really need. But how many different patterns can you make with 4 bits? 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, 2 to the 4th, 16. So we'd actually have to get rid of half of them before we can go down to the next bit size. I don't see how that's going to do it. Well, here's another thing to notice. There are 282 spaces. Like, every word has a space next to it. There's a whole lot of spaces, but on the other hand, there's only one Q in the whole Gettysburg Address.
The ones that appear more often,
or shorter code.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So counterintuitively, we can actually make the code longer for some of the sequences. Like Q, instead of making it 5 bits, we can make it 8 bits. How does that make things better? Well, it makes things better because now potentially we've increased the number of bits in one place, but we can shrink it someplace else. And if we make the space be represented with a very small number of bits, and the Q represented with more to balance it out, we might be able to make the whole thing smaller. So let's work that through. Let's see what happens. So let's say that we take the 4 most common characters and we give them 3-bit codes, and then everything else we'll make into 6-bit codes. So we'll make just a couple of them shorter, but then all the rest of them longer. Let's just work. Could that possibly help? Let's see how that does. So here we have this nice American flag. And what I did here is I sorted all the characters by frequency. So space, E, T, and A are the most common letters in Gettysburg Address. In fact, E, T, and A in English, they show up a lot. Does anybody watch, like, Wheel of Fortune or anything like that? Any of these games? So what are the things that you... Well, vowels you have to buy. That's how important vowels are. What are the big consonants?
R-S-T-L-N.
I think they give you E also.
Oh, when you do like the bonus round or whatever that's called. So E, yeah, E is the most common letter in English by a lot. But then we've got, well, the Gettysburg Address isn't quite... Well, wait, see, what happens after that? Are they sorted?
So A, B, oh no, wait. So E is the most common letter. What else is big here? A, what are the non-vowels? T is big. R is big. N is bigger than M. See, I always think of M as being more important. I'm not sure why. Maybe because of my name. All right. So here's the game. So here's what we did. I just picked those 4 most common ones, and I gave them 3-bit codes. I gave everybody else 6-bit codes. Why don't I give everybody else 4-bit codes?
That seems like it'd be even shorter. Right? So I made S000, E001, T010, and A011. Actually, there's only four of them. Why didn't I give them two bit codes? Well, the thing is now that when we had all characters have the same number of bits in their code, it was very easy to draw these lines to separate them, right? Because I just went five bits, line. If they're different lengths, I need some way of knowing this code that I'm looking at right now. Is it 3 bits? Is it 6 bits? And so the way that I designed this code here is I said, okay, the very first bit tells you if it's a short one or a long one. Leaking people.
Is it that time?
No. All right. So if the first bit is a 0, it's a 3-bit code. If the first bit is a 1, it's a 6-bit code. Okay? So I just made that up. But it's helpful because now we can start to encode and decode and know that we can figure out where to draw the boundaries between the letters. All right. So why 6 bits? Why do I need 6 bits? Well, I need 1 bit to tell you that it's a long code. And why do I need 5 bits after that? Because how many characters am I representing? It's something like, 24.
But you took the 4 out and then you have the 4 short ones.
That's true. Well, I actually didn't take them out. I gave them codes. But I could have taken them out, but it still wouldn't have helped. I still need 5 bits to distinguish between, you know, the great unwashed, and then 1 bit to tell you we're a member of the great unwashed. And then I need only need 3 bits to pick out one of the initial group. So now the question is, does this help? How can we figure out whether or not this helps? Well, first, here's a concrete example. Here's hi there written out. Oh, there we go. So the very first bit in the sequence is a 1, which means that the first letter is a long code, so 6 bits, which happens to correspond to H in the list. The next bit after that is a 1, which means it's another 6-bit code. The next bit after that is a 0, which means it's a short 3-bit code. That's the space. The one after that is a 0, which means it's another short code. That's the T. The one after that is a 1, so it's a 6-bit code. That's the H again. Oh, it's the same as the other H. That's good. The one after that is a 0, so 001, that corresponds to E. The next one after that starts with a 1, 100010, that's R. Then next one starts with a 0, that's E, again, same as before. And then 110011 is period. Okay. So that sequence of bits encodes, hi there. It's a very friendly sequence of bits. The number of bits that we needed to write down high there was 42. If we were doing it in 5-bit codes, there's 9 characters if you count them up. 9 times 5 is 45. So in the regular, you know, the 5-bit code that we came up with, it would have taken 45 bits to write this very short message. But in this case, we only needed 42 bits using the encoding that uses the shorter sequences for some of the common characters. So that's how this code works. It's shorter in this case, only a little bit shorter, but it is harder to work with because now you have to keep checking, you know, is this a 3-bit or a 6-bit, and you have to kind of carefully go through the sequence. So, yeah, more than half the characters have actually gotten longer. How can that help? The thing is, we need to factor in how many of each things there are. So how do we add up the number of bits necessary to write the Gettysburg Address in the new code? So here's what we need to do. First of all, think about all the letter Ys in the whole Gettysburg Address. It turns out there are 10 of them. Okay? How many bits does it take to write down all of those Ys altogether? Well, Y is a 6-bit code in the encoding, and there are 10 Ys, so 10 times 6 is 60. So there's 60 bits just for the Ys. It's longer. It was actually 50 before. 10 Ys you write down with just 50 bits if you have 5-bit codes for everything. So the Ys, all the number of bits that it takes to write down Ys has actually gotten bigger. But look at T. There's 126 T's in the Gettysburg Address. We had been writing them down with 5-bit codes, but now we've got a new code, we write them down with just 3 bits. So that's 378. It was 630. So the total number of bits needed to write down all the E's in the Gettysburg Address, T's, has gotten substantially smaller. So if we wanted to total them all up, here's the formula that we use. The total number of bits in the message is the sum of all the characters in the message, no, all the different characters that you can have. How frequent is that character? Like how many Ys are there? Say there are 10 of them. Times how many bits does it take to write down that character? In the case of Y, it was 6. So 10 times 6. And we add that up for all the characters, all 32 or 28 different characters in the message. Okay? So this formula, if you work out what this formula is, and you can see what's going on here. If frequency is high, then we want length to be low if we want to keep this small. If frequency is very low, then length can be high correspondingly, and it doesn't make that much difference. So if we plug things into this formula, for the Gettysburg Address, there's 282 spaces, and each one is 3 bits, plus 165 E's, each one is 3 bits, plus 126 T's, each one is 3 bits, plus 102 A's, each one is 3 bits, plus 93 O's, each one is 6 bits. So we go through all the letters. For each of them, we multiply the frequency times the length of that letter in the code, add them all up, and we get 6,867 in this case, which is a tiny bit smaller than what it took for the 5-bit code. Okay? So we can get some advantage for by taking into account the frequency of the letters can make us generate a code that's actually more compact for certain messages. So we still have the exact Gettysburg Address. We just write it down with fewer bits, which is pretty neat. All right, 4.6 bits per character. Right. Okay, so what about this? So we got some advantage for making the things variable lengths, 3 bits and 6 bits. What if we make every single letter have a different number of bits? So in particular, we'll make the space, since that's the most frequent, we'll make that 1 bit, just 0 by itself. Then the next most common letter was E, we'll make that 2 bits, 1 followed by 0. The third one, T, we'll make 3 bits, 1, 1 followed by 0. Okay? And so you can do this for the whole alphabet. And what happens is now you get 7.1 bits per character on average for a total of 10,467 bits. It's still smaller than the ASCII representation, but it's bigger than the 5-bit code. This was actually a horrible idea. So now what you have to think about is, well, how am I going to decide? If I have a list of all the frequencies of all the letters, how do I make a code out of that that's as small as possible? I don't want to just have to guess. I would like a recipe or an algorithm that would tell me, given the frequencies, how do I assign code lengths to each of the characters so that the total length is going to be as small as possible. And that's the problem that Huffman solved. So you could, you know, you could try this. Oh, Fano. Fano was the professor. Here's the story. Alright, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to use a kind of code called a tree code or a prefix code. And the point is that you can write down any code as a kind of a tree. And the way that this works is, all right, so here's our tree. All the leaves of the tree, a tree is a kind of graph. All the leaves of the tree, these are nodes of the tree, are the letters that we're going to be encoding. And the path from the root, from the top of the tree down to that letter, is the code. In particular, if you start at the root and you go to the left, at each branch of the tree, if you go left, that's going to be a 0. If you go right, that's going to be a 1. So let's try this. We'll start at the top of the tree, and we'll just pick bits. So we'll say 0, so that takes us down this branch. Now I gotta move. Now if we do 1, 0, that takes us to T. So the code, according to this tree, the code for T is 0, 1, 0. All right, you with me? We'll do a clicker question on one of the other letters. Can you read, they're small. Is it good enough to read? If I ask it? Why don't I just ask the question and then see how it goes? I animated some. Look, there's E. That's 0, 0, 1 is E. And there's W. That's 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1. So this is probably the code that I had before, where the 3 bits are the really short ones and the rest are 6 bits. All right, so It seems like thicker questions are easier when they're on the material that I'm talking about, as opposed to the material I talked about last time. Can I scroll down?
Oh,
you can't even see the tree anymore. Hey, sorry. Actually, they're very tiny now. Does that work? Somebody click. Somebody change your answer and then change it back. Okay, thanks. You can go back to what it was before. So yeah, it's still reading clicks. I just can't tell how many are in yet.
You're talking about the bee that's in the middle, right?
B. All the information's on the receiver. Okay. 5 more seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, remember what I said, that what you want to do is trace the path to the leaf that you want. If you want to encode B, you have to trace it from the root. To the right is 1, to the left is 0. So this B, we have to go right, and then left, 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 right. Right, and then left, 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 right. 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1. So that's the code for B, but from this tree. Okay, so that was the majority answer. Any questions about that? Is it clear? The other.
Can you
do it again? Sure. Let me do it. Chalkboard where it's actually a little easier to see. So okay, so imagine you've got a tree like this. Left branches are 0, right branches are 1. This is the root, this is where we start. So if we wanted to get the letter R, we have to go 0, 1, 1. So the code for R would be 0, 1, 1. A is 0, 0. G is 0, 1, 0. N is 1, 0. P is 1, 1, 0. And L is 1, 1, 1. So what's neat about setting it up as a tree like this is now any bit pattern that we write down is going to correspond to some message in this code. So for example, let me just make up bits without really thinking about it. 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0,
going to be? What's the first letter?
R.
First letters are, right.
Or n.
It can be or n. Yes. But this is important, right? N is 1, 0. R is 0, 1, 1. So what we do is we look at the first bit, start at the root of the tree. It's a 0, so we go left, followed by 1, followed by 1. That's an R. So we've done that letter. Now we go back to the root. 0, 1, 0. That's G. 1, 1, 1. That's L. 0, 1, 1, that's another R. 1, 0, that's an N, only 2 bits long. 0, 0, that's A, another 2-bit one. 1, 0, another N. 1, 0, that's another N. 1, 1, 0, that's a P. 1, 0, that's an N. And then this is incomplete. So there's not a... I didn't finish it. But that's what I wrote down. RGLRNANNPN. For obvious reasons.
But wouldn't... Sorry.
No, it's good.
Wouldn't B
would,
like...
There
would be 0, 0, 0, 1.
Oh, so in this example... So B would be 0, 0, 1. So in this triangle here, we have to go to the left. 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, no, sorry, 0, no, ah. 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1.
How would I start from that triangle?
Ah, then you get one too few bits.
Right.
Yeah, you gotta start at the root. And you don't want to, and it's different if you go backwards. You can't go backwards, you can't go from the bottom up, you have to go from the top down. Alrighty. All right, so the plan next is to actually take you through, I'm going to say this quickly and then we're going to work on some much smaller examples. But now what I'm going to do is build a Huffman code for the Gettysburg Address. So what happens with these Huffman codes is you start off with all the letters. Oh, this is only a partial example anyway. So maybe it's not so important. Let me, here's the completed tree for the Gettysburg Address. Here's the created code. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to go through the algorithm with you how you actually create this code. But let's just look at the result first. Space is so common that it ends up being a 2-bit code, 1-1. E ends up getting it being the only 3-bit code, 1-0-0. Then T, A, O, H, and R end up being 4 bits. Then N through L end up being 5 bits. C through U are 6. Dash through period are 7. Y is 8, line break is 9, K is 10, and Q is 10. So some of these codes, now for some of these letters, the codes are really long. But what's cool about this is all possible tree-like codes, variable-length codes like this, this one gives the absolute shortest length. And as it turns out, the average is 4.1 bits per character for a total of 6,000 bits. It's almost half the size of the ASCII representation of the Gettysburg Address. So, you know, if you've got, you're trying to store the Gettysburg Address and you've got this tiny little thing to store it on, it might have been too big, but after compression, it's gotten to be half the size, and now maybe it fits. So that's pretty neat. There are a bunch of other codes that try to do different sorts of things. So codes, when they send messages between Earth and deep space probes, one of the things that they've discovered is that the deep space probe is transmitting a very small amount of energy and traveling through space. And sometimes by the time it gets to Earth, it's so faint that just a little bit of noise, a little bit of background confusion, and it'll get the wrong bit. So one of the things that they do is they transmit codes in a slightly redundant way. They're called error-correcting codes or sometimes error-detecting codes that say, all right, I don't know what that bit was. It might have been a 0 or 1, but I know that something's gone wrong. And if you know something's gone wrong, you can send a message saying, could you please repeat? So error detecting codes are really useful. In this format that I just gave you a moment ago, if you take any bit in the sequence and you flip it to something else, you get a perfectly valid different message. In fact, it might actually change quite a bit. For example, if you change this one here to a 0,
not only does this G become an A, but all the downstream letters flip. They turn into different letters because we've gone from a 3-bit code in this position to a 2-bit code in this position. So this is a very delicate code. One little bit of misreading of it and the whole thing falls apart. And you don't want that if you're transmitting really valuable information. You'd like to know that something's gone wrong and say, hey, can you send that again? So error detecting codes can tell you something's been modified, and error correcting code can tell you actually which bit was wrong and you can fix it. As long as there's one bit error. And sometimes, so in the book, Hillis actually steps through an error correcting code example. He shows how to build an error correcting code, which is kind of neat that you can do this. You can actually put enough information into the bits so that it's still compressed, but you can recover from various kinds of errors. Another thing that compression programs do, does anybody run any kind of compression program on your computer? Do you know? You do, but do anyone know the name of a compression program that you run?
WinZip?
Zip, yeah. Zip is one. Yeah.
WinRAR.
Win what?
RAR.
RAR. Yes, it's an archiving format. Is that right? Yeah, I think that's true. So there's various kinds of programs that do various kinds of compression. What most of those programs do is a bit more advanced than the Huffman coding, because instead of taking each letter and assigning a code to each letter, they end up assigning bit patterns to whole words in some cases, or even multiple words. So like the shows up so commonly in English text that you don't want to make it T followed by H followed by E. You want to just have a special shorthand character that just means, or sequence that just means the. So when you do this, if you do this right, you can actually get close to what's called Shannon's entropy. Shannon worked out, the same guy who was mentioned in the previous slide, actually worked out what it means for messages to be compressed down to their absolute minimum. So there is a notion that you can take a message, you can compress it down to its Shannon entropy, but no further. If you compress it any further than that, you're going to be throwing away information. So he came up with a whole theory that he called of information that he called information theory. Or at least that's what we call it now. Did Shannon call it that? Do you know?
I don't know.
So anyway, he came up with information theory. It's all about how you take bits, information, codes of various kind, and compress them and transmit them and fix them, and it was all very, it turned out to be very, very useful stuff. All right, so what I'd like to do is go through a Huffman coding example, and then I can show you some other demos of compression in action. But let's, since I'm going to ask you about Huffman coding on the exam, we might as well kind of go through that. So here's the game. The way that I'm going to ask these questions is we're going to take a word, just a regular short word, and come up with a code for the letters of that word. So I should have an example at the ready, but I don't. We can try reindeer. All right, so let's say we're trying to come up with a code where each letter of the word reindeer is going to get its own bit pattern, and we're going to try to make that code as short as possible. And the way we're going to do that is by taking advantage of the fact that some letters are more common in this word than others. So there are two R's, three E's, one I, one N, and one D. Is that everything? Okay. So here's how we make the code. Here are the steps. The first thing we do is we have the frequencies for all the letters. Take the two letters or the two things that we've got with the highest frequencies, and we're going to merge them together in a tree. And it doesn't matter which one's the left and which one's the right. It's not going to change the answer. So first thing we're going to do is we're going to make a tree that has R and E as the leaves. Okay? We're going to get rid of R and E from our list, because we used them up. But now we've got a new thing in our list, which is R and E together, and that has a count of 5. Okay, it had 2 from the R and 3 from the E, so now it's got 5. So now we repeat this process. We take the two biggest things and merge them together, which is this, which is a 5, and any of these 1s. So let's say the I. We merge these together, like so. I'm doing this backwards. This is going to end up being horrible. All right, so let me fix it. Sorry about that. There are two R's and three E's. Forget most of what I said, but the thing that you need to fix is you take the two smallest things and merge them together, make them a unit. The merging the two largest is what the professor guy did. What Huffman came up with is, no, what if you just merge the two smallest ones? That turns out to work. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to take two of the smallest ones and merge them together. So here we've got N and D. Each have a weight of 1. The combination has a weight of 2. Now we take the two smallest ones. Well, what are the two smallest ones? There's I, that has a weight of 1. R has a weight of 2, but this also has a weight of 2. We can choose either of them. Which would you rather I choose, R or this, to merge?
R.
Sure, all right. So now we're going to merge R and I. R has a weight of 2, I has a weight of 1. When we merge them together, we get something that has a weight of 3. And I and R are off this list. So now our list consists of E with a weight of 3, this thing with a weight of 3, and this thing with a weight of 2. We merge the two smallest, which is the 2 and one of the 3s. So let's just choose this one because it's right in front of me. We merge them together with a weight of 5. Now all we've got left is the E and this whole mess. So we're going to take the E that has a weight of 3 and merge it with the rest of it to create something with a weight of 8. This 8 is, by the way, the number of letters in reindeer, because that's all we've been doing, is just adding the letters together. This is our code. What's the code? Was this 0 when you go this way?
Yeah.
0, 0, 0 is I. 0, 0, 1 is R. 0, 1, 0 is N. 0, 1, 1 is E. And 1 is E. So E ends up getting a 1-bit code in this example. Yeah?
Wait, how do you put an E in that tree?
When you merge a tree, you take two trees, you take their roots, and you just link them up. So I took E, which all by itself, and made it the right branch, and made the rest of this thing be the left branch. All right? And so this gives us a code where everybody has 3-bit codes except for the E, which has a 1-bit code, for a total of, how long is reindeer now? It's 3 bits of E plus 2 R's. Each R is 3 bits, so there's 6 bits of R. There's 3 bits of I, 3 bits of N, 3 bits of D, for a total of 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. 18 bits for reindeer. Okay? So we should be able to take any word and go through this process and come up with a code for it. What people actually do, or what computer programs actually do, is take much bigger blocks of text, right? Like take all of the newspaper articles from the Associated Press Newswire, and they'll count up all the letters and build the tree, and that'll be something that's really good for English in general. This code is really only good for reindeer in general. But it's easier for us to do than actually computing statistics on the entire corpus of newspapers.
Did you get those numbers?
So this 6, so there are 2 R's in reindeer, and according to this code, R is 3 bits long. So the first R is 3 bits, and the second R is 3 bits, for a total of 6 for the R's. The E's were 1-bit codes, and there's 3 of them, so that ends up being 3. Okay? So I'll probably ask a quicker question about this next time to reinforce it. We've got 9 minutes till the end of class. Let me show you one more video.
What's the deadline for homework for that extenuating?
You should get the homework in today, unless you have extenuating circumstances, in which case you should let me know.
Oh, no, I mean like the exact time of this.
I think the exact time is 5 o'clock, so it's in the. It's like. It's either, yeah, it's now or just a little while ago. But if you get it in by the end of the day, that's fine. If you need past today, please let me know. So compression is really important. Not only is your computer doing it all the time, sometimes on purpose when you ask it to, sometimes even when you don't ask it to, but cable and HD, they seem to be doing this all over the place now. To get your video signal to you more efficiently, they compress it. And it actually is what's called lossy compression. They actually throw away some of the information. So you can't recover the original video back from what they send you. And it's fine, mostly, but sometimes you'll see what's called artifacts. You'll see things that just you know are wrong.
and are just there because of the compression algorithm. So I went looking on YouTube. I'm not sure if these are going to work, but I went looking on YouTube for examples of this, because if you've never seen it, then, you know, good for you. But now I'm going to show it to you, and you'll never be able to not see it again. So basically, I'm going to ruin cable viewing for you if I can. Have people noticed this? Do you see that? He's watching sports, it comes up a lot. One of the things they do for the compression is so what's really happening is there's a computer someplace at the broadcaster's area that actually has the whole video sequence stored there in its real format. And what it does is it looks through it and finds ways of shrinking it. It sends that information across the cable, then you've got a computer on your side. The cable boxes often will have computers in them that will take that information and decode it back into an image. And so one of the things they do to compress the image is if there's big patterns, big parts of the image that are all the same color, instead of transmitting the individual, you know, oh, this block of the image is this color, this block is this color, they'll just take that whole region and they'll send a message that says this whole region, and they'll tell you the corners of the region, is this color. And so the whole region will end up being filled in with one constant color. Which is fine, except sometimes you get these artifacts when it's not really a constant color, but it treats it like a constant color anyway. So here's a football montage from last year. But what you want to be looking for here is not so much the athletics, but the weird things that happen in the image, especially around the edges and in areas that are all the same color. What's that? I don't think that'll work. Okay, sure. I'd be happy to. Ah, that didn't help. Go back. All right, if you look around the region. It's hard to see. Look around the edges. You'll see these weird blotches of color. Look. It was there briefly. Look at his shirt. There's weird rectangles that are all the same color that you know don't correspond, edges of which don't correspond to anything that's actually on his shirt. So look for these weird colored rectangles. Let's see. Look at the. All right, it's too fast.
You need to pause it.
Yeah, I think pausing is going to be important. The thing is, when you pause it, sometimes it's harder to see that they're there. All right, so let's. This isn't a great example. If you look in the weights here, there's these big splotches that are actually uniform color. There's probably a lot more detail here, but it's getting glossed over. What's happening is they're transmitting information that just says, hey, just color all that in. It's almost like a coloring book at this point, right? It just sends the shape of the region and says, make that this color. Even though in reality, there's a lot more subtleties going on there. Look, it's much better over here. You see this gray border right there between those two? I'm not making it up, right? You can see it.
Oh, yeah.
There's no line there in reality. The line is only there because the compression algorithm said, you know, these guys are mostly this shade of gray, and these guys are mostly this shade of gray, and it put an artificial boundary between them. In reality, it's much more gradual, the color shifts. But to transmit a gradual color shift, that takes a lot of information. It's much easier to just say, make all these the same, make all these the same. And so what you'll see is this kind of stepping pattern. As you go across left to right, it's the same color, and then there's an abrupt change, and then there's an abrupt change. And this is happening all over the place. And the weirder thing is if the image changes really fast, like you have, sometimes you'll see in a TV show, like there'll be two faces up close, and they'll be looking at each other real close. And then all of a sudden there's a switch to, it's an outdoor scene. And like nothing is carried over from one to the next. It basically has to transmit. Another thing that they do is that instead of just saying this region is all the same color, they'll just say this region is the same as it was a second ago. And it won't send any additional information. So it just stays the same. And sometimes, the artifact is, sometimes it'll stay the same longer than it really should. And you'll see somebody who's walking and their leg will like stay back and then suddenly jump forward. Because it's like, well, it was not moving that much. So let's just say it doesn't move at all. It's easier to transmit that. And so there's these weird things that you get. So if you look for it, if you watch this in kind of slow motion, you start to see more and more of these, especially
during the abrupt shifts, or if something's been constant for a long time and then suddenly changes. You see all sorts of rectangles going by just then. The field, look at the field. As it's moving fast, you see the rectangles kind of turning colors?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? Once it stays steady, it starts to fix the colors. But when it's moving fast, it kind of cheats. And you get these blocky rectangles all over the place. Around the edges of people, it doesn't do those very well either. You see almost like a ghost effect. The checkerboard in the end zone, it does horrible with that. What's that? Now it looks like there's a circle around that guy. All right, but anyway, the more you compress it, the more you start to see these artifacts. And one of them is called macro blocking, and that's what I want.